headlines. Afghanistan is facing an urgent need for medical supplies to provide treatment for thousands of injuries following the recent tragic earthquake. Fresh violence by Israeli occupation forces takes the life of one more Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. And Ukrainian forces preparing for a full withdrawal from the flashpoint city of Severodonetsk, bringing Russia closer to the capture of Luhansk. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. In Afghanistan, five more people have died in an aftershock in almost the same area of a major quake in the east on Wednesday. That adds to over 1,000 people killed on the day the natural disaster happened. There has been no immediate word on the extent of the new damage and injuries. The country's disaster ministry says over 2,000 were injured on Wednesday. It also says around 10,000 houses were partially or completely destroyed. Authorities have ended a search for survivors. The 6.1 magnitude quake was the strongest to hit Afghanistan in over two decades. Officials say the country lacks the necessities to treat the injured or provide the survivors with food, water, and shelter. A number of countries have offered emergency aid. Three humanitarian aid flights from Iran have landed in Afghanistan.
After a nine-hour-long trip from the Afghan capital Kabul, we have arrived in Gayan district in southeastern Paktika province. The residents have to stay outdoors in the cold weather, without access to basic needs.
All houses here have been ruined as a result of the earthquake. In some areas, all members of a single family have been killed. Currently, women, children, and elders are in a very bad situation and need urgent help.
Next day, as the sun rises, we visit more quake-ravaged houses. People still continue the search and rescue operation. It seems like every home here has had some killed or injured.
Mr. Naim Khan says that he has lost two of his relatives and five others are injured. We ask him about this earthquake and about the situation here.
At around 1:30 a.m. Wednesday, the earthquake struck here. Two of my family members were killed and five others injured. We also lost our livestock. Our livelihoods and food supplies are buried under rubble. There's nowhere to go. We need help and our houses should be rebuilt.
Four of the Taliban ministers and aid agencies arrived in the collapsed villages to address the needs of desperate people. They're providing food items, blankets, tents, medicines, and other basic necessities. But it's clear more help is needed.
The leadership has ordered all related governmental institutions to reach the quake-stricken areas and take necessary measures. In addition, the Prime Minister is going to pay money to families of the victims.
Humanitarian aid agencies have arrived here to carry out the required programs. Based on our assessment, more than 8,000 houses have so far been confirmed destroyed here in Gayan. These affected people need help immediately.
The earthquake comes as Afghanistan is facing drought, famine, and hunger, triggered by cuts in global aid and the U.S. sanctions. The Taliban officials have called on the U.S. to release Afghan frozen assets. Rahmatullah Baghban, Paktika province of Afghanistan.
Moving on, Palestinian teenager has succumbed to injuries he sustained by Israeli gunfire in the occupied West Bank on Friday. Israeli forces hit 16-year-old Mohammed Hamad during a raid in the town of Silwad. He is the second Palestinian to fall victim to Israeli violence in 1 week. The other one was killed near Akalaya refugee camp. Israeli forces have accused him of trying to cross the separation barrier. The situation remains volatile across the occupied territories, with Israeli forces and settlers keeping up acts of violence against Palestinians. Troops often resort to live rounds, citing different pretexts against Palestinians protesting against raids or illegal demolition of their homes. Tel Aviv has also intensified detaining Palestinians, including children, who are being held without charge or trial under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. Our correspondent Mona Kandel has joined us from Ramallah, telling us more about Israeli brutalities and the killing of another Palestinian at the hands of the regime forces.
Israeli forces usually on Fridays raid Palestinian areas to prevent anti-Israel demonstrations and protests. These are protests that take place in order to be against the Israeli settlements and the Israeli separation wall and the confiscation of the land. This is what happened yesterday. Israeli troops raided Silwat town, East Ramallah, and they used their fire. They fired towards Palestinians who were taking part in an anti-settlement protest in Silwat. 16-year-old Muhammad Abdullah Hamid from Silwat was shot and wounded, and the Israeli troops took him when they pulled out from the Palestinian town of Silwat. Later, the Israeli military declared that this 16-year-old Palestinian succumbed to his injuries. However, we have to mention that the body of Muhammad Abdullah Hamid is still with the Israeli forces. A number of Palestinians had been also wounded yesterday, Friday, in numerous locations in the occupied West Bank.
An investigation by the UN Human Rights Office has concluded that veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists covering an Israeli raid in Jenin were targeted by, quote, seemingly well-aimed bullets. This report has more.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Akleh came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, was killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Akleh in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, the UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Akleh's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well or not, will end anytime soon.
The Syrian army has launched a ground military operation against the Daesh terror group in the northern province of Raqqa. The operation kicked off on Thursday, taking place in an area in southeast of Raqqa province. It followed increased activity by remnants of Daesh terrorists in that area in recent weeks. Now, that is according to Russia's Sputnik news agency, citing local sources. It says government troops backed by Syrian and Russian warplanes have killed a number of terrorists without specifying. Just earlier this week, Daesh claimed a bus attack in the same Raqqa area that killed 13 people. Syria has long complained that Daesh and other terror groups it is fighting are backed by Western states. Moving on now to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. Officials in Kiev say they have ordered troops to withdraw from Severodonetsk, a key battleground in the eastern Donbass region. Officials say they aim to avoid more casualties and allow forces to regroup as very little are left to defend the city. The withdrawal marks the biggest retreat by Ukraine since the loss of the southern port city of Mariupol last month. The pullout is also seen as a significant Russian victory over Ukraine's eastern commercial hub. The war, which began 4 months ago, is now focused on the eastern Donbass region. With the fall of Severodonetsk, it is adjoining city Lysychansk and likely become a new battleground in the east. Recent Russian advances appear to bring closer to taking full control of Luhansk province. That is a key province in Donbass. We're joined now by our correspondent on the ground in the city of Donetsk, eastern Ukraine, Johnny Miller, who will give us an update. Johnny, how close is Russia to capturing Severodonetsk? Have Ukrainian forces already started pulling back?
Yesterday, Ukrainian forces started withdrawing from Severodonetsk. There's been a battle going on there for over a week. Now it was clear for some time that it would be Russia that would win that battle. Hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers are being killed every day around that city. Horrific loss of life. Also strategically impossible for them with those kind of losses to win that battle. So they're withdrawing yesterday and today. Many prisoners are being captured by the Russians. The Luhansk People's Republic say that they are capturing hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers. I have seen some videos of particularly two prominent Ukrainian soldiers who've been captured. Russia has also closed what it calls the Gorsky Cauldron surrounding Ukrainian troops to the south of Severodonetsk. There's still some Ukrainian soldiers held up in the Azot chemical plant, full advance for some time, but in the coming days and week may well see large Russian gains. But Ukraine and NATO have made clear that they fight for every inch of the Donbass, so it's only a matter of time until there's a battle for another part of the Donbass. But Russia has now effectively taken the whole of Luhansk, or will officially declare that in the coming days. But now they've got to take the rest of Donbass. Now, in Donetsk, the Ukrainian army has been shelling the city through the center. But yesterday and today has been quiet because of Russian strikes on the city, or it may have something to do with the air being more concerned with the Russian army advancing to the north and less concerned with shelling civilians here. Because that is ultimately Russia's aims, to sweep down through and take the rest of Donbass. Some independent analysts are saying that's simply a matter of when rather than if, and say that it's not possible for Ukraine to win this conflict in the Donbass anyway. As they're sustaining hundreds of losses every day, and Russia has superiority of artillery and air power.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Johnny Miller, joining us live from the city of Donetsk in the eastern Donbass region. The chair of the International Monetary Fund says the United States is facing an increased risk of a recession. Christina Georgieva warned that there is a narrowing path for the U.S. to avoid recession. The warning comes as the Federal Reserve introduced the biggest rise in benchmark lending rate in nearly 30 years to tame the rallying prices. U.S. inflation is at a four-decade high. This is squeezing American families struggling with inflated costs of fuel, food, and housing. The IMF chief also pointed to the Russia-Ukraine war and what she called the uncertainty of the current situation. She warned that further negative shocks would inevitably make the situation more difficult. Jack Rasmus is a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College. Citing the measures taken by the Federal Reserve this year, he believes that an economic recession is unavoidable in the U.S., and it is only a matter of how soon it will happen.
I don't think the U.S. can avoid a recession. The only question is how soon, how deep, and how long. When you raise interest rates this quickly, and we got to assume that the Fed's going to continue doing that a couple more times, 75 basis points. When you raise interest rates that fast, the historical record shows that you always fall into a recession. And that's especially true now, I think, because the U.S. economy contracted in the first quarter of this year. And the forecast by the Atlanta District Fed is that there'll be no growth in the second quarter. So, you know, we're almost on the cusp of a recession already, and now we're raising interest rates at the pace that they indicate. I've been predicting for over 6 months now that should the Fed raise interest rates, then we're going to have a recession. You know, the IMF is always very conservative. It's always lagging behind the actual trend in the economy, the global economy, the U.S. economy, very conservative in its forecast. It always adjusts further when reality changes.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. After more than 4 years of talks, 52 countries and the European Union on Friday, 24th of June, struck a deal to modernize the Energy Charter Treaty, a 1994 agreement that allows investors to sue governments for changes in energy policy that harm their profits. We have prepared for you an article written by Jennifer Rankin. The piece is titled, Activists Say Energy Treaty Update Fails to Address Climate Crisis. Climate activists have said a deal to update a dangerous energy treaty has failed to make the agreement compatible with the urgency of the climate crisis. After more than 4 years of talks, 52 countries and the European Union on Friday, 24th of June, struck a deal to modernize the Energy Charter Treaty, a 1994 agreement that allows investors to sue governments for changes in energy policy that harm their profits. The treaty has been described by a former whistleblower as a real threat to the landmark Paris Climate Agreement, which aims to cap global heating at 1.5 degrees Celsius, because it is feared that governments would blow their green transition budgets on compensating the owners of coal mines, oil wells, and other fossil fuel projects. Recently, 76 climate scientists told European Union leaders that even a modernized Energy Charter Treaty would jeopardize the European Union climate neutrality target and the EU Green Deal, referring to a swathe of policy proposals launched last year to tackle the climate crisis. The compromise agreement, which was largely designed by the European Union, reduces the protection afforded to companies that have invested in oil and gas projects. But a fossil fuel exemption would not kick in until 2033 at the earliest. Under the deal, new fossil fuel investments will cease to be protected in the European Union and United Kingdom from mid-August of 2023. Existing fossil fuel investments in the European Union and United Kingdom would lose protection after 10 years. But the 10-year phase-out for the oil and gas only comes into force once the treaty has been ratified by three-quarters of the Energy Charter Treaty's 53 signatories. Moreover, the fossil fuel carve-out does not bind countries. While the European Union and Britain have chosen to end protection for oil and gas investments, other Energy Charter Treaty signatories such as Central Asian states, Switzerland and Japan can maintain protection for fossil fuel investors. Member countries are expected to formally approve the deal in November, but it will still need to be ratified by each capital. Amandine van der Berger, a lawyer at the non-governmental organization Client Earth, said, "With a 10-year phase-out period for fossil fuel investments, European Union countries could still be sued for putting in place progressive climate policies for at least another decade. The key window for action if humanity is to avoid climate catastrophe." Referring to the decision to extend treaty protection to these areas, she said, "The new treaty will also open the door to a wave of financial compensation claims, protecting investments in energy sources and technologies raising significant sustainability concerns, such as biomass, hydrogen, and carbon capture storage." Amandine van der Berger added, "The bottom line is, we are still left with a dangerous agreement that will obstruct urgent action to tackle the climate crisis for years to come. The European Union must finally do what is necessary for climate and legally right. It must walk away." France, Germany, Spain, Poland and the Netherlands have called on the European Commission to study withdrawing from the agreement. This week, Spain's Deputy Prime Minister went public with her concerns. Speaking before the outcome of negotiations was confirmed, Spain's Deputy Prime Minister, Teresa Ribera, said 14 rounds of talks on reforming treaty had made clear it fails to ensure the alignment of the Energy Charter Treaty with the Paris Climate Accord and the objectives of the European Green Deal. She told the website Politico it was time for the European Union and its member states to initiate a coordinated withdrawal. Her intervention cast doubt over whether the European Union can ratify the treaty, which also must be approved by the European Parliament. European Union officials say their negotiating position was endorsed by all 27 EU member states. Officials argue that withdrawing from the treaty does not protect European Union interests because investors would have a 20-year period to sue governments because of a lengthy sunset clause. The European Commission said the modernized Energy Charter Treaty preserved the right of governments to pursue their public policy objectives, including for climate change mitigation and adaptation. This fully preserves the European Union's ability to develop our climate policies. We have thereby aligned the Energy Charter Treaty with the Paris Climate Accord and our environmental objectives. Climate activists disagree, however, contending that countries could quit the treaty and agree to protect each other from Energy Charter Treaty claims. Chloe Mikulaczek, a spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion Belgium, said, "We're talking about timeframes that could protect the benefit of the fossil fuel industry well into 2030. And the thing is, we don't have time to wait until 2030 for climate action. We need it right now." On Thursday, 23rd of June, Extinction Rebellion activists delayed the start of treaty negotiations by about an hour by gluing themselves to meeting tables before their protest was broken up by police. Outside the Brussels headquarters of the European Charter Treaty Secretariat, a few dozen activists staged a die-in, lying on the entrance steps amid fake oil, with a banner reading, "Stop protecting fossil fuel profits." Chloe Mikulaczek said they would continue to target the treaty among any policy that is harmful for the climate. The British government welcomed the agreement, saying it would protect the UK government's sovereign right to change its own energy systems to reach emissions reduction targets in line with the Paris Climate Accord. Greg Hands, the energy minister, said, "The United Kingdom cannot support an outdated treaty which holds back investment in clean energy and puts British taxpayers at risk from costly legal challenges."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The United Nations has published its findings about the killing of veteran Palestinian reporter Shirin Abu Akleh last month. It says it was Israeli fire that killed the journalist who was wearing a vest marked press while covering an Israeli army raid in the occupied Jenin. The UN probe suggests that she and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the significance of the report and its possible consequences for Israel.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Akleh came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, was killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Akleh in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, the UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Akleh's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
Well, joining us on tonight's edition of Spotlight, we have journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joining us from Vancouver, and professor of political science at Al-Azhar University, Mohammed Abu Saada, joining us from Gaza City.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Barakat in Vancouver. The UN says all the evidence points to Israel, and it was Israeli fire that killed Palestinian reporter Shireen Abu Akleh last month while she was covering an Israeli raid in Jenin. Share with us your perspective on this UN report and its ramifications and consequences.
Yes, well, this is a repetitive situation. Almost Palestinians, since the beginning of the occupation of Palestine in 1948, and Israel have been carrying these kind of atrocities and murder against Palestinian journalists and writers. And Shireen Abu Akleh was targeted Palestinians across political line, including the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian Resistance Forces, Al Jazeera Channel, Palestinian journalists. They all say from the very first hour that Israel have killed Shireen Abu Akleh. Now, the United Nations, when they confirm the Palestinian story, like they do all the time, the question that Palestinians ask, so what is next? What is this international body going to do regarding Israeli crimes against Palestinians in general and against Palestinian journalists and writers? You know, Palestinians remember that Israel once had something called Golda List, referring to the Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir. She had an entire list of Palestinian writers and journalists that they assassinated all across Europe, from Mahmoud al-Hamshari to Majid Abu Sharar to, Ghassan Kanafani in Beirut, and many, many Palestinian journalists were assassinated at the hands of this Israeli racist colonialist regime. So what are they going to do about it? Shireen Abu Akleh also is a U.S. citizen. What is the U.S. Position on this? And also there is a completely, shamelessly justification of the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, particularly by the United States, who always take the side of Israel and cover Israel crimes in international body. So today Palestinians are asking the international community, what are you going to do about it? Every time you do an investigation about an Israeli war crime, and you prove that Palestinians were right and the occupiers are liars, but then nothing happened. So, sure. So there is a feeling of anger and frustration across Palestine and across Palestinians in the diaspora.
Let's bring in Mr. Abu Saada on that issue as well. First of all, I want to get your overall perspective on the situation. But Mr. Barakat mentioned the United States. That was a question we had a little later on in the program. I'm going to jump to that question right now. On Thursday, 24 U.S. senators, they sent a letter to President Joe Biden urging that the United States be directly involved in investigating Abu Akleh's death, citing a lack of progress toward the establishment of an independent investigation. Also, the fact that Abu Akleh was an American. The letter said the U.S. government has an obligation to ensure that a comprehensive, impartial, and open investigation into her shooting death is conducted. The question is, will Washington be pushing for such an investigation? This does put the U.S. in a tight spot given the circumstances of the killing, doesn't it?
Good evening, and that is definitely a very good question. But if you could allow me just to make a short comment on the probe by the UN Human Rights Office before answering that question. Let me say that this is not the first investigation which has been reached the same conclusion that it's Israel and the Israeli occupation forces that killed Shireen Abu Akleh. CNN and other American media outlets have reached the same conclusion by saying that is it was the Israeli security forces. And one U.S. investigation by the media outlet has basically reached the conclusion that 16 bullets were fired at Shireen Abu Akleh, which one of them killed her immediately, and another one that reached or injured her colleague, Ali Samoudi. That is one thing. The other thing, let me say that the probe by the UN Human Rights Office was transparent, impartial, that the UN basically said that they have inspected photo, video, and audio material and visited the scene, consulted with experts, reviewed official communications, and also interviewed witnesses who were on the scene, that this is against the Israeli claim that there was a shootout between Palestinian militant and the Israeli occupation forces, and that's why Israel has refrained so far from conducting a criminal investigation into the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. Now, answering your question, yes, since Shireen Abu Akleh is an American citizen, there is an outcry among many progressives in the Democratic Party in the U.S., and around half of members of the Democratic Party in the U.S. Senate has called on the president and called on the U.S. administration to get involved in the probe of the investigation, to get involved in the investigation of the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. But unfortunately, the U.S. government or the U.S. administration has failed so far to take this case seriously, to put enough pressure on Israel to conduct a criminal investigation into the death of Abu Akleh. And unfortunately, the U.S. has very much acted as acted as a country that who served impunity to Israel and impunity to the Israeli criminal acts against the Palestinians and journalists in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Mr. Barakat, a Palestinian probe, as we know, has found that Israel deliberately killed Shirin Abu Akleh. What message does this killing, was it intended to be sent by the Israeli regime? Is it a warning to journalists who want to report on Israeli crimes in the future?
It is absolutely the same message, and it is the same goal by Israel, and that is assassinating Palestinian journalists and writers and those who either carry the Palestinian narrative and stories to the world, or they are defending their own people with their words, with their creative work. And when Israel was shooting journalists in Gaza during the March of Return, you know, marches for 18 months, they were targeting their eyes. They were turning them into blind. And we have tens and tens of cases of Palestinian journalists, camera persons, Palestinian short story and novelist writers. These people are always targeted by Israel because Israel doesn't want the Palestinian story to be told. And they don't want this story to be told by Palestinians. And they don't want their story to reach out to the world. But it always, Israel fails of killing Palestinian, you know, journalists and writers because they become immortal for our people, and more people will know them, and they become a conscious of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement, and that's why, you know, we are going to be organizing international workshops to expose Israel target killings of Palestinian journalists and Palestinians in general. I do not differentiate between assassinating a Palestinian journalist or assassinating a Palestinian student leader or a union leader or a Palestinian fighter or a leader in the resistance. Israel targets all Palestinians regardless of the way and the shape they struggle. Regardless of the way you struggle against this occupation, Israel will target you. And this is the Palestinian historical experience with the colonizers for the past 100 years. Britain, when it ruled Palestine, killed so many Palestinian journalists and writers as well. Israel is doing the same thing. In fact, Israel is using British law in order to criminalize Palestinian journalists and keep them in administrative detentions. Hundreds of Palestinian writers and journalists are today in Israeli presence. Mm-hmm. They still write, they still do every chance they have to write and to get their material out of prison and to be translated and their stories to be told. And, you know, it is really, you know, it is really a task of our struggle and not something, you know, that foreign for us.
Mr. Abu Saad, our guest in Vancouver, he phrased it very nicely. He said that Israelis will target Palestinians regardless of the shape and form of their struggle. The Israeli forces even took it a step further when they beat mourners carrying Abu Akleh's body during her funeral procession. Unpack what happened on that day for us. Was it again the Israelis using vicious tactics and fear-mongering against Palestinians, in the words of Mr. Barakat, targeting Palestinians regardless of the form of their struggle?
Well, let me say that Israel, unfortunately, is acting like a country above international law. And unfortunately, the impunity which has been provided to Israel and the Israeli occupation forces by countries like the U.S. and U.K., United Kingdom, unfortunately, that has allowed Israel to go without any kind of punishment. What the Israeli occupation forces has done to the funeral of Abu Akleh is very much telling us that Israel doesn't care for international public opinion and doesn't care for any UN criticism or any UN investigation. Israel claimed that that East Jerusalem is under Israeli sovereignty, and they were trying to deprive the Palestinian from raising the Palestinian flag in the Shireen Abu Akleh funeral on that day, which led to clashes between Palestinian Palestinians and Israeli forces. And let me tell you, that day was very much instead of Israeli claims that East Jerusalem is under Israeli sovereignty. On that day, the Palestinian people liberated East Jerusalem from the Israeli occupation. That was the longest and the biggest funeral that East Jerusalem has ever seen, maybe since the death of Faisal al-Husseini about 20 years ago. So unfortunately, what Israel is trying to do to submit the Palestinians to deprive the Palestinians from their self-determination and from their political rights. And what happened, it was a backfire that the Palestinians succeeded in raising the Palestinian flag all over Jerusalem on that day and made Jerusalem a Palestinian sovereign city instead of Israeli claims that East Jerusalem is under Israeli sovereignty. But let's go again back to what the international community has done to punish Israel. Unfortunately, the UN system, the international community, hasn't been acting as impartial or transparent when it comes to Israeli violations of international law, when it comes to Israeli war crimes, which has been documented by prestigious international organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, who have basically indicated that Israel is implementing an apartheid system against the Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Israel has succeeded to go without any kind of punishment because of the impunity which has been provided by governments like the U.S. government.
Mr. Barakat, Israel has in recent months intensified its attacks on the in the occupied territories. Jenin has been the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians there. There were also some reprisal attacks against Israelis, even in the heart of Tel Aviv. Give us your perspective on the significance of these operations as Palestinians have been venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
Israel recently is definitely escalating its crimes against Palestinian people in Palestine, in the West Bank, particularly in Jenin. And also, Israel is escalating its aggression against the region in general. We saw that they destroy the Damascus airport, for example. They are, continuing to pose threat against Lebanon. Israel, what they're doing now at this time is they're trying to run away from their internal crisis. This is a regime that cannot find a suitable administration for its affairs. The Israeli internal front is shaky. They are divided. They don't know which direction they're going. Israel in the past used to be able to justify its project for their imperialist and colonialist backers. But today, Israel have no project, and it's reaching its dead end. And the more Israel commit crimes against Palestinians, the sooner Israel will end as a Zionist settler project in Palestine from the river to the sea.
Mr. Abu Sada, your final thoughts on the issue as well. You can address what Mr. Barakat just mentioned, as we're going to have to wrap up this show pretty soon.
Thank you. Well, look, the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people has been going on for the past 74 years, since 1948, when Israel expelled more than two-thirds of the Palestinians from their own villages and their own homes. And this Israeli criminal acts against the Palestinians continued since the occupation of West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem in 1967. For more than half a century that the Palestinians have been living under Israeli occupation and have been deprived from self-determination. Gaza, the house of 2 million Palestinians, has been living under extreme Israeli siege and blockade. And let me tell you that no day goes by without Israeli occupation forces or Israeli settlers are killing Palestinians. Just 2 days ago, an Israeli settler in the West Bank city, village of Iskaka, stabbed a Palestinian youth and killed him. A Palestinian in the age of 27 was killed by an Israeli settler, and the Israeli occupation forces didn't even intervene to protect the Palestinians or to allow the Palestinian medics to take that Palestinian patient to the hospital. He was taken to the hospital and died there. Israeli atrocities and Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people is going day after day. And unfortunately, the Prime Minister of Britain, Boris Johnson, is saying that we will not allow the ICC to prosecute our friend Israel.
Okay, I'm sorry,
Israel has been provided and granted impunity from countries like U.S. and U.K. Thank you.
Apologies, I'm going to have to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for this program tonight. Journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joining us from Vancouver. Mohaimer Abu Saada, professor of political science at Al-Azhar University, joining us from Gaza City. Thank you very much. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's tip, servitude, ubudiyyah, is necessary for worship, ibadah, to be considered real worship of Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Now, dear listeners, talking about ubudiyyah and servitude being necessary for our worship, the oneness of the apparent and the hidden is a concept which should be understood. Now, under certain circumstances or in the presence of certain people, a person may do certain things that are contrary to their inner and personal state. This is also called ostentation. This is a type of riya, ostentation, which is where under certain situations or because certain people are around you, you try to cater your actions, towards that specific person. So let's say you are reading your prayers, the five daily prayers, the salah, and all of a sudden you feel like somebody has walked in the room. And then you start to read your prayers in a very beautiful voice, in a very, I don't know, spiritual manner. Well, here you should know that this is riya, because you are doing this for that person who has come into the room, not for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And it is interesting, but on the Day of Judgment, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, go and ask your reward from that person whom you did your actions for. May Allah save us from that day, dear friends.
Ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah, ya
Allah. IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, ya Rahman, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. Ya Allah, ya Mannan, haqqiq amanina. أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Muhibbin, which means the whispered prayer of the lovers. Stay with me. God, place us among those whose habit is rejoicing in you and yearning for you, whose time is spent in sighing and moaning. Their foreheads are bowed down before your mightiness, their eyes wakeful in your service, their tears flowing in dread of you, their hearts fixed upon your love, their cores shaken with awe of you. O He, the lights of whose holiness induce wonder in the eyes of His lovers, the glories of whose face arouse the longing of the hearts of His knowers. O furthest wish of the hearts of the yearners, O God, O utmost limit of the hopes of the lovers, I ask from you, love for those who love you, love for every work which will join me to your nearness, and that you make yourself more beloved to me than anything other than you. And make my love for you lead to your good pleasure, and my yearning for you protect against disobeying you. Oblige me by allowing me to gaze upon you. Gaze upon me with the eye of affection and tenderness. Turn not your face away from me, and make me one of the people of happiness with you and favored position. O responder, O most merciful of the merciful. فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جرد ولا رمق بكم يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقى الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جرد ولا رمق ولا العبد الفقير ولا.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. And so in this regards, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, one who is as honest in his secret activities as in overt deeds, and whose words and actions suit, is the person who has faithfully discharged the duty laid down upon him by the Lord. It is the person who has honestly handed over the things entrusted to him, and is the person who has sincerely obeyed Allah only to achieve Allah's favors and blessings. So, dear friends, Imam Ali alayhi salam tells us that one needs to be honest